All right, the marshal may bring us to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Smith, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to counsel and other interested observers. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has six cases on its calendar, three of which are being submitted by oral arguments, three of which are being submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. We are now ready for the third case for oral argument, which is case number A20-0016, Evans versus Evans. I might just do a quick sound check. I think I counsel for respondent. Can you see and hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And counsel for appellant, can you see and hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, it appears that we're in good working order. As you know, each of you has 15 minutes for your initial allotment of oral arguments. You, appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. When you are not speaking, I would appreciate your muting your mic. So Mr. Miller, you've got a computer set up. I'm not showing that you're muted now. If you were to speak right now, I think I can hear you. Go ahead.
Your Honor, we had to call in by phone because we have a camera that doesn't have an audio function. So I'm not muted on Zoom, but I just muted on my phone.
Well, but I heard you. So
that's because I unmuted my phone. I can mute it on Zoom as well, Your Honor. It's just that I don't have any audio connected to the Zoom call directly through the computer, so it doesn't matter if I mute that or unmute that. I just mute it on the phone, which is what you're hearing me through.
I see. Well, we would the purpose of your muting your Zoom mic is so that if you have any crosstalk with your counsel or you're rustling papers or so on, that then it doesn't interrupt opposing counsel's argument. Okay, it appears that you're totally muted now. Thank you for doing that. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Galili, please correct me, my pronunciation, if I got it wrong. You may proceed on behalf of your client, appellant and cross-respondent Keith Evans.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honor, the questions today in front of the Court of Appeals is really two issues. It can break down to the issues of the unsecured family loans and then the district court's order regarding spousal maintenance. Now, the appellant's issues, as the court saw with the brief when it comes to the family loans, is essentially that the appellant does not believe the district court had the authority to force the parties to satisfy the unsecured family loans directly from the proceeds of the house. And this was the $94,000 in family loans that were outlined in the court's order.
Was that an issue that you, counsel, was that an issue that you raised to the trial court?
Your Honor, we raised the issue to the trial court as far as my client's request for the family loans not to be paid directly from the proceeds of the sale of the house.
Yes, but the constitutional claim that you made in your brief, you did not raise that to the trial court.
I believe we raised it in theory, but we did not brief it or file any memorandums specific to that issue. Now, the language...
Oh, go ahead, Judge.
What do you mean you raised it in theory? I'm not...
In discussions with the district court and as part of our arguments to the court, we argued that the family debt should not be paid directly from the sale of the proceeds of the house. I don't believe we directly raised the constitutional issue of the homestead exemption, but we did raise the concept of taking these unsecured debts, making them secured and forcing them to be paid through the sale of the proceeds of the house.
Well, what is our standard of review then on the claim that the homestead proceeds should not have been used? Is it abuse of discretion or is it a law question?
Your Honor, I think that's a very good question. I believe from my briefing, there's not a lot of case law on this specific issue, but I do believe that the Court of Appeals should look at it for an abuse of discretion.
So if I can just, counsel, just follow up a little bit. So apart from that application, your asserted application of the homestead exemption, is there any other basis on which you would challenge the district court's order with respect to the proceeds of the house? Or are you relying entirely on the homestead exemption as the argument?
I believe for this purpose, Your Honor, we're relying on the homestead exemption. My client's testimony in the transcript was regarding the fact that it wouldn't be equitable to force the parties to take an unsecured debt, make it secured, and have them pay it from the proceeds of the house directly. And our issue was not whether or not the court had the authority to do this. I believe the court has the authority to order the parties to be liable for marital debts. That's not an issue. And opposing counsel in his brief attempted to make that the argument we're making. But the argument we're making is that the unsecured debts themselves, my client wanted to remain liable for them. And in his testimony to the district court, he asked that the parties remain liable.
Right. I understand that, counsel, but I'm just trying to, again, pinpoint exactly what we're being asked to review here. Because I think when you opened, you said that the district court did not have the authority to order the proceeds of the home to be used to pay debts. I think you used the word the court's authority, which sounds then like a legal argument that relates to the homestead exemption entirely. Like that's where you think the court, that's what you think deprives the district court of the authority to do it. And apart from that, it sounds like you don't have a legal argument. You have an abuse of discretion, whether that was the right thing to do in this family law case. So with respect to the legal, well, I might be putting words in your mouth and you should correct me if I'm wrong. With respect to the homestead exemption, were there not potentially some factual issues that a district court would actually need to develop to determine whether the exemption, whether it is a homestead, whether there's been abandonment, whether, you know, issues such as that, such that the court not being presented beyond theoretically, but actually in fact with the question of homestead exemption, needed an opportunity to look at that?
Your Honor, I do believe that that's a very fair point. And I just want to characterize, and I think it was clear in our briefs, but our contention is regarding the unsecured family debt is that my client specifically agreed that the first 9 debts listed to be paid from the house would be paid. And so we're not raising any large issue with those, but just specific to this $94,000. Now, Your Honors, the larger issue when it comes to spousal maintenance that the appellant is challenging this is this award of $2,507 a month. And in our brief, the way that I presented it to the court is almost looking at it backwards. We have a very detailed 33-page order. I don't think there's any questions that it's lengthy. It has a lot of details regarding testimony. I think there's questions on accuracy of those that we'll address. But the number 2507 only shows up 4 times in the transcript. And all 4 times that argument comes, that number is from trial exhibit 18-3 and scenario 3, which was called the share the pain scenario that was presented by a wife at the trial. And that scenario essentially equalized the parties' budget so that they're both under budget by the same amount. And that scenario had them both with a spousal maintenance order of $2,507 would leave them both equally under budget by $772. Now we have several.
Was this the budget that the trial court found to be appropriate, or was this the claim budget?
That's a good question, Your Honor. This budget was the budget proposed by wife for her post-disillusion expenses after her move to New York or New Jersey, her out-of-state budget. So she proposed 2 budgets to the district court, her current expenses at the time of the trial and her expected budget after the sale of the party's homestead and her move out of state. The budget that was included in that scenario 3 for wife was the budget for when she would be after the sale of the homestead and after her move out of state. And that budget, the court specifically found in its footnote when it cited to why this would be a 10-year maintenance order versus a permanent, said that the expenses that petitioner or the wife put forward after her move were too speculative, and they were too speculative to appropriate another award or a permanent award.
I thought, and, I mean, did the district court say too speculative or somewhat speculative? I thought that it acknowledged some degree of speculation, but nonetheless found that they were adequately proved.
Your Honor, I believe that the footnote said too speculative, but I do not have that in front of me. It's a footnote on the bottom of the court's order when addressing why it's a temporary order versus a permanent order. But and so our issue is the district court acknowledged that this budget was speculative. And one of the reasons is, and this was brought up in cross-examination of the petitioner at the time, was because she budgeted things such as rent at $2,800 a month. She budgeted health insurance at $700 a month, but she didn't know where she was moving yet. We didn't know if she was, moving to upstate New York, lower state New York. Those prices are obviously very different. And this is the court this is the issue that we raised in the district court, is that living in New Jersey is different than Southern New York. Manhattan is different than Pittman, New Jersey. These expenses that she proposed were speculative because she didn't know where she was moving. And this was her testimony. She hadn't found a house. She hadn't found a job. She hadn't found a neighborhood to move into. And we believe that that's why the district court found that these expenses were too speculative. Now, it seems to me that there are several contradictions in the district court's order. Besides this footnote, regarding the speculative expenses, is because these expenses she proposed were 10 months down the line at the time of trial. And the trial took place in November, and her petitioner's move was not to take place until the following summer. And so the district court used the budget that it found too speculative to award the $2,507 in maintenance, which came directly from that exhibit. Lastly, there's I think a more minor issue of the misapplication, mischaracterization of the maintenance as income to the petitioner and a deduction to the respondent. Now, the reason we're raising that issue, I don't think there's a question that was an error. But it was, again, because that scenario 3 took into effect the tax consequences, including the income to petitioner and the deduction to respondent, and that would significantly change the numbers on that spousal maintenance.
So, counsel, I just wanted to make sure that, so you're saying that FinPlan didn't account, was not up to date with respect to the plan was not up to date with respect to the law.
Your Honor, it's a very good question. Yeah, it's a very good question. I don't believe it was, but it wasn't my FinPlan proposal. And I guess.
And why do you not believe it? Well, I mean, the language in the court's order is just, says this will be the tax treatment of it. It doesn't say this is what FinPlan considers. So I'm wondering why, because there seems to be some difference of opinion as to whether FinPlan was up to date.
Yes, Your Honor. The way that I did it was by looking at the exhibit. And when I saw, I think I wrote in my brief that the income being paid by the spouse maintenance being paid by husband to wife on wife's column showed up as income, where it wouldn't show up as taxable income. It should have been in the non-taxable income section. And so when I reviewed that scenario 3, to me, it looked like the numbers were inserted in the taxable section for income instead of the non-taxable, and that would affect the overall number that came out for maintenance. Now,
How would it affect it? What are the numbers? What's the difference that it makes?
I don't think it's very significant. I think it can make, from what I saw, I think it can make a difference of $200 or $300. But it was another issue that we raised as far as these numbers, this 2507 number not being an accurate number, being based
on. But if a number isn't perfectly accurate, I mean, as an appellant, you have to show us in order to get a reversal that there's something that it makes a difference, I think. So besides just saying, well, that wasn't an accurate number. I mean, who knows? Maybe the accurate number is should have been that the maintenance is higher. In which case, how are you? Is your client disadvantaged? So I think you have to show us that there's a difference that warrants reversal, even if there is a mistake, don't you?
I think that's a fair point, Your Honor. And you know, I guess my position would be is I'm not asking for reversal just solely based on that mischaracterization or that issue of the deduction, but taken as a whole with all the other errors would leave the 2507 number inaccurate. But I think the strongest compelling argument here, Your Honor, is the fact that in a sense, my client was imputed income at trial. And this, again, you know, appellant testified at length in his trial about his transitional employment being terminated, the new businesses he's forming, the 60-hour weeks he's working, the commitment and the belief that these businesses, the two businesses, would bring revenue down the line. And the court itself found that it found respondent's testimony regarding his current employment to be credible. Now, there's contradictions, I believe, in the court order on this issue. There's language that said respondent testified that he's currently unemployed. We believe that's an error of fact. And the transcript is clear on this. His whole testimony was on the fact that he's employed in two separate businesses, working many hours and putting in all the effort. There's a second contradiction, we believe, where the district court says that husband testified that he could easily obtain employment in a position in another sales job. And in my brief, I went through and brought from the transcript the line of questioning from opposing counsel to my client on that. And my client never testified that he had another sale opportunity or another job. The question was related to could he work in any sales area? And he said, yeah, I'm a salesman, I can sell. The review of husband's testimony shows that this finding you can't have it both ways. It can't be that his testimony was credible and then that he was either voluntarily unemployed or underemployed. And I cited several cases.
But counsel, I think as I understand, and I know we were running toward the end of the time, is I think there's agreement that a district court can rely on earning capacity if determining income is impracticable, or if a person is unjustifiably self-limited, their income is unjustifiably self-limited. The district court relied on the first factor, that it's impracticable. You say that your client was in fact employed. So he was in fact employed, he's working hard. He testified to expected income. And because of the nature of the business and his skills at selling and blah, blah, blah. What is wrong with a district court in that circumstance deciding that it's impracticable right now to determine income because there hasn't yet been payoff, but he fully expects there to be payoff, and then to turn to earning capacity? I mean, that's consistent with his credibility and everything. It's only on the impracticability, not on the bad faith.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please proceed to answer the question.
Okay, thank you. Your Honor, I think our position is that had the district court made additional findings that it's basing his income on his earning capacity, he had no income, he had no pay stubs, he had no money coming in. So had the district court said, you know, we have an issue calculating his income because he has $0 coming in and we're going to impute income on him, the case law that I cited to the court seems to suggest that there either has to be a finding of bad faith or unjust, that he unjustifiably limited his income, neither of which were present. And in fact, I'd argue the opposite was present. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Galili. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, is it Mr. Miller?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Miller. I represent respondent cross appellant Karen Evans, who I'll refer to as wife. I'm going to address the issues that appellant Keith Evans, will be referred to as husband, addressed regarding the payment of the family debt from the sale of the marital homestead and the spousal maintenance issues in the order that he referenced them in his brief. As the court has already addressed, the husband is attempting to apply the homestead exemption statute to the allocation of marital proceeds or the net proceeds of the marital homestead to family debt. There is absolutely no law supporting that proposition. And as the court has already indicated, and Mr. Galili has conceded, that issue was never raised at the trial court level, not in theory, not in any way. So it is not properly before the court. Even if it had been raised and it was before this court, it clearly does not apply. The homestead exemption statute is a debtor-creditor statute. This is not a debtor-creditor situation. This is a situation where the court is awarding the proceeds of the marital homestead to the parties, not to creditors, so that the parties can pay off their debts. As set forth in our brief, there is ample authority to demonstrate that the apportionment of debt is part of a fair and equitable allocation of personal property. It's also important to note that the husband is simply...
Counsel, if I may, yes. Though, but the court did order that the creditors be paid, didn't just apportion the debt between them and order the sale of the house. It didn't have to do it this way. It could have just ordered the sale of the house. Proceeds come in. The parties are responsible for their evenly split the debts, or each responsible for the debts. It's not like it was obligated to do it this way.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think it's important,
ordering a payment to creditors.
It is, but it's not an action commenced by a creditor. The homestead exemption statute deals with actions commenced by creditors to foreclose a lien on or a judgment on a marital homestead. In this case, the parties are being awarded the proceeds and they are being ordered to pay off their debts, which is relatively common in my experience. And one of the rationale for that is to make sure the creditors actually get paid off. My client had substantial concerns that the husband wouldn't pay off the debt, particularly the family debt. And case in point, he's raising that issue here. He's trying to accept out the family debt from other marital debt for absolutely no reason other than he doesn't feel like it's warranted. He refers to that as unsecured family debt, but all of the marital debt that has been ordered to be paid from the marital homestead sale is unsecured. None of it is secured against the real property except for the mortgage. And the mortgage isn't at issue because we're talking about the net proceeds. So there's absolutely no reason to accept out the family debt. He simply doesn't want to pay it. Now, in his reply brief, he raises an argument that goes beyond the homestead exemption statute, which, again, is not properly before the court because it wasn't raised in his initial brief or in our responsive brief. But he talks about whether or not it's enforceable, whether a collection was sought before trial, and the fact that it wasn't in writing. All those issues are inaccurate. First of all, at trial, there was testimony from not only my client, but from my client's sister, Ms. Shaffron, that the debt was expected to be repaid after the sale of the marital homestead when the divorce was complete. It's also clear that the payment of a debt does not need to be in writing in this context.
Mr. Miller, if you have answered Judge Smith's question fully, could you please turn to the taxation issue?
Certainly, Your Honor. With respect to the taxation issue, this is a relatively straightforward issue from our perspective. The FIN plan scenarios were produced by the wife in connection with trial, and they were admitted into evidence as Exhibit 18. There was five different scenarios. Scenario 3 was the one that was ultimately used.
I'm looking at it right now.
I personally did the calculations for this trial. The FIN plan software that we have was updated for 2019. As the court is aware, the tax law changed effective January 1st, 2019, where spousal maintenance would not be deductible after that date to the payor. And if the court looks at line 36 of scenario 3, which is also true in the other scenarios, it specifically shows the tax impact of alimony at $0. That shows that there's absolutely no merit to the husband's claim that there was some type of tax impact because of his payment of spousal maintenance. Now,
So Mr. Miller, I'm looking at lines 12 and 13. One, it just says alimony. The next line says non-taxable maintenance. I guess I'm wondering, I mean, I think appellant's argument is that the 2507 should have been on line 13 instead of line 12. Is that correct?
I would say no, Your Honor. The line 13 is a holdover in the software from prior years where most maintenance was taxable and you could agree on non-taxable maintenance. The categories didn't change. But when the software was updated, alimony, whether in category 12 or 13 had no tax ramifications. And again, that's corroborated by line 36. If there had been tax ramifications for the spousal maintenance being on line 12, it would show on line 36. And there were no tax ramifications. I think
is there something in the record that explains what the meaning of line 36? I mean, you've given it, you've explained it, or you've said what it means to you, but I'm just wondering if that is exactly what the software writers meant.
Well, I can't speak for the software writers, Your Honor. It wasn't addressed in the trial court because this issue was never raised by husband until the appeal. So what I'm telling you is that the exhibit that was admitted into evidence at trial demonstrates that there was no tax impact. The issue with regard to the FinPlan cash flow scenarios is that husband had an opportunity to object to them before trial, like other exhibits. And he did object to other exhibits, but he didn't object to this. He didn't object to the FinPlan scenarios at trial. He didn't object to them in his post-trial submissions. And he never submitted any of his own cash flow scenarios. So the only thing the court had was our scenarios, which were basically unrebutted. And I would like to get into the spousal maintenance issue. As Mr. Glilly indicated, the court has awarded my client $2,507 for spousal maintenance per month. One of the arguments that Mr. Glilly raises is that there was no basis for an imputation of income. We believe that's inaccurate. The court specifically addressed the unjustifiable limitation of husband's income as a basis for spousal maintenance in this case. And when I say specifically, the court addressed numerous facts that support that conclusion. The Warwick case specifically indicates that the trial court does not have to say there was bad faith. It just has to appear from the facts in the decree that there was adequate support for the premise that the payor unjustifiably limited his income.
Well, this so that's interesting, counsel, so as what you're arguing, there are two ways to argue this, I think. One is the district court relied on the not unjustifiably self-limiting income, but relied on determining income is impracticable in going forward and dealing and relying on earning capacity. And there isn't any requirement for that test, impracticability, that the person act in bad faith or that they're unjustifiably self-limiting or anything. It's just that it's impracticable because I suppose it varies so much. There are different factors to consider, and et cetera. So we're going to rely on earning capacity. Now you seem to be arguing, and maybe you argued this in your brief, but I didn't really see it, but maybe, is that put aside that the court relied on that, let's look at unjustifiably self-limiting. And even though the district court didn't rely on that, let's read into its factual findings that that's in fact what was happening here. Which way are you arguing?
Your Honor, we're arguing that both are adequate bases for the court to have awarded spousal maintenance. The court did determine expressly that it was impracticable to determine the husband's income because he had no revenue at the point of trial, and it was unclear if he would have revenue from his business in the future. But the findings.
So why, if the court made no finding about unjustifiably self-limited, and I don't see a finding in there that says, you know, I see the impracticability finding, I don't see a self-limited finding, but you can point me where that is if I'm wrong. Why are we talking about that here?
Your Honor, there isn't an express finding that said that Mr. Evans, the husband, unjustifiably limited his income. However, the findings of fact list a number of factors that demonstrate how the husband did unjustifiably limit his income. So we've argued in our brief that in addition to his income being impractical to be determined, he's also unjustifiably limited it. And the court, the decree addresses that in detail without using those words. And what I was referring to in the Warwick case is that it's not reference to whether the express words are used, but whether there's support for the position that there's an unjustifiable limitation by husband. The husband worked for 28 years in the shoe sales industry.
Well, I see those facts as going to determining earning capacity. You know, you look at what someone has done, has earned in the past, how, et cetera, the factors I think you're about to tell me. But isn't it a question of fact as to whether the obligor has self-limited income? I mean, at best, wouldn't we have to remand it under your theory that if the, I mean, you're suggesting that the district court implicitly found it, but I guess what the court was, I mean, one way to look at it is that the court was just simply finding earning capacity, not finding unjustifiably self-limiting income.
Well, the court did find the husband's earning capacity, and it wasn't just right. based on the position of the wife. The husband admitted during cross-examination, which Mr. Gulley attempted to address earlier, that he could earn as much or more as he was earning in his last shoe sales position. He specifically said that he could go into another sales area and earn as much money, but he chose to follow his passion.
Counsel, I understand that the court found earning capacity. In order to rely on earning capacity, the court has to find either impracticable to find the income or self-limiting income. And you're so focused on the second one, which kind of surprises me because the court didn't rely on that second one and didn't find that second one. The court relied on the first one, impracticability, and then went on to find earning capacity, which looks at a person's history and so on. I mean, earning capacity needs one of those two reasons in order to rely on it instead of actual income. And it surprises me that you're focusing so much on the second one.
Well, I don't intend to focus just on the second one. I was trying to explain that one, Your Honor. The court did specifically find that it was impractical. I was just also attempting to explain how there would be a basis for an unjustifiable limitation of the husband's income, having switched industries 4 months before trial to an industry he had no experience in, had received no revenue at the time of trial, and this was while a spousal maintenance claim was pending against him. The husband's expenses that he claims, were improperly stated, they were correctly adopted by the court because he included the cost for the marital homestead taxes, and which would not occur after the payment of those debts from the sale of the marital homestead. He also included adult children expenses. So his expenses were properly adjusted. The wife's expenses, she testified in detail about the investigation, the research that she did to determine her post-dissolution expenses. And that is why we address it in detail in our statement of facts and our principal brief. Now, the court did reference that her expenses were speculative. In fact, the court did say too speculative in that footnote that we were discussing earlier. But that was in the context of the duration of the spousal maintenance. Wife disagrees that her expenses were speculative. There is some estimation involved anytime you're dealing with expenses. But we contend that, there was an adequate basis for those expenses and that the court improperly stated that they were too speculative for the purposes of duration, which leads me into the cross appeal issue. The wife is asking for permanent spousal maintenance, and permanent spousal maintenance is warranted in this case because whenever there's any doubt about the duration of maintenance, whether it should be permanent or temporary maintenance, Minnesota Statute 518.552 and case law, including Nardini and Gates, both specify that the doubts are to be determined in favor of permanency. The issue of modification can be addressed in the future if there's a permanent award. It's also important to note that on pages 9 and 10 of the judgment and decree, the court went over factors D, E, and F in detail, which were the durational components of subdivision 2 of 518.552. And in each instance, the court concluded that each of those factors warranted permanent spousal maintenance. Yet the court erroneously went on to conclude that it should be temporary maintenance. We're contending that should have been permanent maintenance.
What about the fact that the court also found that wife was capable of being self-supporting? I don't have the order in front of me, but that preceded the discussion of the factors. You probably know where that is. Later at the end of it talked about, when retirement, she would be eligible for retirement, presumably. Can you just speak to that and how that factors in?
Certainly. The only thing I can conjecture, Your Honor, is that there was an error on the part of the court. The reference that you're referring to is on page 6 of the findings of fact. But then on pages 9 through 10 of the judgment decree, the court goes through the factors in detail and says that she needs permanent maintenance. And with regard to factor F, the court specifically states that she's not capable of self-support. Can I just briefly finish, Your Honor, and give my conclusion?
Yes, you may.
Okay. It's also not disputed that the wife is not capable of rehabilitation. That wasn't raised by the husband, and the trial court concluded that she wasn't capable of rehabilitation. Thus, permanent spousal maintenance is appropriate in this case. In conclusion, the wife respectfully requests that this court affirm the trial court's determination that the sale of the marital homestead proceeds can be allocated to all marital debt, not and including the family debt, that the amount of maintenance of $2,507 per month be affirmed in favor of wife, and that the trial court be reversed with respect to the permanency of, or the duration of spousal maintenance, and she be awarded permanent maintenance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Galilei, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. I would appreciate it if you would begin by addressing the cross appeal, the issue of whether maintenance should be temporary or permanent.
Absolutely. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, it's our position, as you know from the brief, that we don't believe the court erred as far as temporary versus permanent maintenance. I believe it was cited earlier that the court found that wife's going to receive an interest in the retirement assets. Those assets aren't liquid, but would support her in her retirement. That was a direct finding. Nowhere did the district court find that wife was unable to work, and nor did she prove she was unable to work full time. And there was a presumption of employability, and that wasn't rebutted. And contrary to opposing counsel's position, if the court did in fact make clearly erroneous findings, like he said on page 6 regarding its quotation, there should have been a motion for amended filing that was filed with the district court prior to this court of appeals to address an issue such as that. Now,
would you agree that we have some inconsistencies in the district court's order on this issue?
Absolutely. I do believe that there are inconsistencies, and that can't, that's directly in the language.
And so how would you suggest that we reconcile them?
Well, I guess I'll clarify. Our position on the inconsistencies was that the court made these specific findings, but in the court's overall analysis at the end on permanent or maintenance, the court went through the analysis and found that wife did not prove that she was unable to provide self-support. I don't know where opposing counsel also says wife's not capable of rehabilitation. I think that that's a little vague as well. And I don't necessarily think that was directly found by the court. The contention that she's entitled to permanent maintenance despite her inability to prove that she wouldn't be self-sufficient is our issue. The court had issues with the speculative employment status. She wasn't aware of whether she would receive, she received medical assistance in Minnesota. She wasn't aware of whether she'd receive that in on the East Coast or not. And she wasn't sure whether she'd have a job or not. So there was no way for the court to know, I guess, that she wouldn't be self-sufficient. And I believe that that's what the court made in its findings regarding duration. And just very briefly, Your Honor, since I only have 2 minutes left, on the issue of impracticability or self-limiting, again, even though I do agree, I believe that the court find that it would be impracticable to calculate my client's income, I don't believe the testimony supports that. There wasn't testimony that he had profits or losses. He had zero income, and the court could have found and should have found that he has zero income. It wasn't impracticable to calculate. And if in fact he has zero income, which was the facts, now we're transitioning to whether or not it was he was self-limiting in income, which is the argument opposing counsel made at trial in his briefs and today. And the issue that we have with that is, again, and I believe that the court found it earlier, that there's several court of appeals cases that hold that when you're imputing income for spousal maintenance, you either have to find bad faith or that the obligor unjustifiably self-limited his income. And again, no words of bad faith, no words of unjustifiably limiting his income. Those facts aren't there, and I don't think it's fair to read them in there. The Court of Appeals case in Walker versus Walker specifically found that bad faith remains a prerequisite to determining maintenance based on an obligor's earning capacity. And again, the word bad faith, nowhere to be found in the transcript. Unjustifiably limited his income, nowhere found in the transcript. There's no findings that he voluntarily quit his job. He was terminated and he received unemployment. That was against his will that he was terminated. The court should not, the district court should not have imputed those income on him without those findings. Finally, Your Honors, the request that we have to the court today is that the court remand the issue of maintenance, the 2507 number. That number, we fast forwarded through this earlier, but I addressed it in my brief. That number puts my client under budget, even on the income that they're imputing on him, the income that he doesn't have. Even with that income, on scenario three, he's over $700 under budget. He doesn't, that's an inability to pay maintenance. And so one way or another, whether it was incorrectly calculated, imputed income on him, even with that income, he doesn't have the ability to pay. And therefore we think that issue needs to be remanded to the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
But the scenario three exhibit, trial exhibit 18-3 shows that both parties have a monthly deficit that's equal, right? I mean, isn't it within the district court's discretion to fix maintenance at an amount that would have that result? Is, you know, which is characterized as the share the pain doctrine. Is that an abuse of discretion?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe that the obligor has to have the ability to pay. And if
But I mean, so in other words, that's determined independent of the obligee's budget?
I believe so, Your Honor. If the obligee in a situation was $2,000 under budget, but the husband has a budget of $3,000 and only $3,000 of income a month, I would argue that wife's not entitled to spousal maintenance, even though she has the need. He doesn't have the ability to pay. And I think that that's true in this scenario as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That's the last case. And so